ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, with your host, Tim Banal.
Hello out there, my friends. This is Tim Banal of BanalofAmerica.com with another edition of Banal of America Audio. It is February 4th, 2006. This week we have Colm Kelleher, co-author of Hunt for the Skinwalker, one of the most talked about books of the holiday season. Hunt for the Skinwalker tears the lid off the Nids Skinwalker Ranch in Utah and takes us inside what was going on at the Skinwalker Ranch all these years, and has some just amazing and chilling stories about some of the phenomena that were occurring at the Skinwalker Ranch while Nids was doing its research. A little bit about Colm Kelleher, for those of you unfamiliar with him. He is a senior research scientist with a 20-year career in cell and molecular biology. Following his PhD in biochemistry from the University of Dublin Trinity College in 1983, Dr. Kelleher worked at Canada's flagship Ontario Cancer Institute, the Terry Fox Laboratory at the British Columbia Cancer Research Center in Vancouver, and the National Jewish Center for Immunology and Respiratory Medicine in Denver. More recently, Dr. Kelleher served as research director for Bigelow Aerospace in Las Vegas and as administrator for one of its subsidiaries, Space Sciences, Inc. Dr. Kelleher also acted as team leader and project manager for the National Institute for Discovery Science, NIDS. Currently, Dr. Kelleher is the director of labs for a biotechnology firm in San Francisco. He has authored 38 peer-reviewed publications in molecular biology, immunology, biochemistry, and virology, as well as articles in popular magazines such as Omni. His websites are colmkelleher.com, that's colmkelleher.com, and huntfortheskinwalker.com is the website for the book. Let me spell that for you. It's HuntfortheSkinwalker.com, and that's the website where you can find more information about the book he co-authored with George Knapp called Hunt for the Skinwalker. And that's what we're here to discuss this week. During the course of the interview, Colm's dog was making some noise in the background, so eventually that stopped. But in case you hear some what sounds like a weird noise in the background, that's the dog. Don't worry, everything's cool. This interview was conducted on January 21st, 2006. Colm Kelleher on Banal of America Audio.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of Banal of America Audio. My guest this week is Colm Kelleher. He's the co-author of Hunt for the Skinwalker, about the Nids Ranch in Utah, and he was the project manager and team leader at a private research institute at National Institute of Discovery Sciences, which is NIDS. And he's also well known in esoteric circles for his Mad Cow and CJD research and the book Brain Trust. And he has a PhD in biochemistry, and he is the guest this week on Banal of America Audio. Welcome to the show, Colm.
Great to be here, Tim.
Why don't you just give me a little brief bio on how you ended up at NIDS?
Well, my background, as you mentioned, is in biochemistry. I was working in a institute in immunology in Denver, Colorado, in 1996 when I saw what I thought was a very interesting ad for research managers in a new institute that was published in Science Magazine, which is one of the premier science journals. And the ad was specifically looking for people who were willing to research the origin and evolution of consciousness in the universe. Now, how often do you see an ad like that in Science Magazine? So obviously I was intrigued enough to answer the ad. At the same time, as an immunologist, I've always been interested in the effects on the immune system of altered states and different stress levels on the immune system, as well as physiology in general. So when I heard about this new organization called the National Institute for Discovery Science, obviously I applied, and I was successful. So I moved from Denver to Las Vegas in 1996 to begin working as a research manager at the National Institute for Discovery Science. And It was a very, very unusual organization in that it was specifically formed in order to study the quote-unquote paranormal or anomalies, which included UFO sightings, cattle mutilations, and you know, the usual cast of characters in paranormal phenomena. And what was different about NIDS was that it was fully funded Robert Bigelow, who was the CEO of an aerospace company and also a real estate entrepreneur in Las Vegas. So he hired a bunch of professional scientists as well as a science advisory board, which had a lot of expertise in different topics, including physics, chemistry, biology. There were medical people on board. There was psychology people, computer science experts, and forensics. And all of these people were mainstream scientists who worked in government labs and academia. So National Institute for Discovery Science had both full-time scientists on its staff, as well as a very well-qualified science advisory board. So it was not the kind of usual investigation of paranormal phenomena that people talk about. In other words, people are doing it on their own time on weekends or you know, during the evenings kind of thing. So it, you know, from that perspective, I think the NIDF was a very unique organization.
Now, how long were you working for NIDS before they picked up the Gorman Ranch?
It was very quick, actually, because the Gorman Ranch began to sort of filter out into the media in summer of 96. I joined in August of 96, so there was a very short period between joining and actually getting involved on the ranch. My first trip to the ranch was in September 96, so it was very fast, actually.
Okay, and yeah, let me just do a little background here on the book, because the book is about the ranch, the infamous NIDS Ranch, that many in Esoterica have heard about and talked about for so long, and finally the book has come out. It's one of the most talked about books of the holiday season, and now everybody, I hope, has either picked it up and read it, or is going out and getting it after this interview, or they're going to shut off the interview and buy it and read it and then listen to the interview. But it's definitely, you got to check out this book. It was awesome. I loved it. And it's about this ranch. First, this family moves there. All kinds of crazy stuff happens, giant wolves, UFOs, Bigfoot-type sighting things, just poltergeist-type activity, crazy stuff. They eventually can't take it anymore. They move out. The NIDS, the National Institute for Discovery Science, buys the ranch, and they install these fine folks, these scientists of whom Colm was one of. Is that pretty much the gist of the story?
Yeah, that's correct. The family, I think, were at the stage of mental and physical exhaustion by summer of 1996. And so they started reaching out for help, and word got out into the media, and we heard about it in July or so of 1996. Now, at this stage, the family had been on the property for about 20 months, which is a very short time, but during that period, out of a herd of 80 cattle, which was their livelihood, they bred high-end cattle, like Black Simmentals, Black Angus. Out of a herd of 80 cattle, they had either lost, disappeared, or had been killed, 14 animals. So a normal attrition rate for this kind of an operation was one animal per year. But 14 animals had disappeared or been killed in 20 months, and they were essentially economically bankrupt. At the same time, they had been exposed to almost daily or weekly extremely stressful events that they could not explain. This was a salt of the earth family who were basically looking to set up a ranching operation in a quiet area of northeastern Utah, and they just wanted to get about their business, but they were constantly besieged by phenomena they could not explain, to the extent that they lost sleep. The kids in school, their grades fell from straight-A students all the way down to D's, and they just couldn't sleep. So by the time we actually took over the property, they were all sleeping in the same living room in this small property, on the floor, just for protection, basically, in numbers. They were so traumatized by what had happened. They hadn't had a decent night's sleep in a couple of months. So they were ready to get the hell out of there as quickly as possible. And when NIDS saw the potential, we instantly purchased the ranch and set it up as an experimental laboratory in the paranormal.
Now, in the story, you guys are investigating stuff, and often you say it wasn't enough to bring to the science board. Do you follow me? Like the Now, what? Like, explain to me this sort of how that was set up. Like, were they kept sort of out of the loop, or they didn't go there and check it out too? It's sort of like you would bring what you guys found to them, and then they. But it wasn't ever enough.
Well, the Science Advisory Board, some of the members actually visited the property on a number of occasions, but there were 15 to 16 people on the board. They were all working in different parts of the country. They were extremely busy in their mainstream jobs. They worked in either research laboratories, universities, or government laboratories. So they had, you know, very busy day jobs. So
sure.
Every couple of months, they would be flown to Las Vegas for a series of briefings.
Oh, wow.
From the NID staff who would spend all the time on the property. We would compile all of the data that we had come up with, including any photographs, any tracings, magnetic field tracings, any videotape, and we would essentially go into these exhaustive briefings over a several-day period. And the Science Advisory Board were looking for evidence that was deemed acceptable in mainstream science, and you know they were pretty strict about adhering to scientific protocol. So all of the evidence that was collected, certainly in the initial stages, were basically eyewitness testimony from NIDS researchers who were on the property. They saw weird stuff. A lot of the stuff that we saw was very transient. It was difficult to capture on film because it was there one moment and then it was gone the next.
Yeah.
It rarely reappeared in exactly the same spot. So, you know, setting up cameras, which we did in a particular area, sometimes didn't yield the kind of results that the Science Advisory Board was looking for. But in general, they were extremely supportive. I mean, some of them actually became mentors to the project, and they were in touch by either telephone or by email practically every week. So it was not sort of like this group of scientists who were sort of removed from the whole project. They were extremely well aware of what was going on a weekly basis, but they were flown to Las Vegas every couple of months and given these extended briefings that lasted over a few days.
And now you know about how the paranormal, so there's a stigma attached to it, studying it. Were the scientists on the science board and you guys at the ranch and stuff, was it sort of kept on the down low with these guys so it wouldn't hurt their reputation, or was it pretty well known that they were part of the NIDS board?
Some of them did agree to release their names publicly and their association with NIDS, but quite a few of them refused because for exactly the reasons you've given. And to this day, there are several members of the NIDS Science Advisory Board whose names have never been made public, and that is because some of them were extremely well known in their own fields of science, and their reputations would be tainted by association with this kind of a study. No matter how rigorous and no matter how scientific this study was, the fact is that it is considered totally off limits by mainstream science. It is considered flaky. It is damaging to one's career. You can lose research grants. You can lose your reputation. And once your reputation has gone in science, obviously everything else starts going down the toilet.
Yeah, exactly. Now, maybe you can answer this question for me. It was kind of like, I'm just a suburban guy. I didn't understand this. The Gormans lost a lot of cattle. Then they moved, but there was still cattle at the NIDS ranch. Did they not move the cattle, or how did that work out? Or was this NIDS provided cattle?
Well, the NIDS organization actually purchased a lot of the cattle from the Gormans in order to set up exactly the same conditions on the property as had been experienced in the 20 months before we bought it. So the organization actually owned the cattle. They had been sold by the Gormans to NIDS, and so we installed them essentially to keep the environment in as close approximation as previously. So when the Gormans moved off, they had they moved to about 25 miles away from the property. Tom Gorman, the family guy, was kept on at NIDS as a ranch manager for a few years because he was absolutely outraged at having been thrown off his property by something he had no idea of what was constituting the force that forced him to move off. So he was determined to find out as much as possible. He was looking to NIDS to see if he could find some answers.
Yeah.
So he joined the NIDS organization as a ranch manager on the property. So he became a ranch manager on the very same property that he had owned in the previous 20 months. And he did it purely to find out some more answers. And, you know, this guy was the salt of the earth. He was not sort of given to delusions or sort of fantasies. He was extremely interested in whatever had killed his cattle because, you know, it was a violation of his own privacy. It was a violation of his property rights. And he had no idea of who or what was doing this to him or had done it to him. So he stayed on. The rest of the family moved off to about 25 miles distance. Then a few years later, they moved out of state and they've been trying to put this whole episode behind them. They don't want to be talked about. Or they don't want to be contacted.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, when you guys first got to the ranch, he suggested a less is more type attitude in studying. Do you think you guys went along with that, or do you think you didn't go along with it enough, or what did you think of that sort of perspective on doing the study of the ranch?
Well, we moved onto the property as quickly as possible. We installed a command and control center on the property right beside where the rancher had been living for the previous 20 months. We brought in a lot of equipment, including recording equipment, and we installed people 724 on the property. The Gormans, especially Tom Gorman, was advising us to, and in hindsight, it may have been wise to take his advice, but we were intent on tracking whatever this thing as quickly as possible. So his advice was take it softly, set up a command and control center, you know, 10 miles away, be on the property as if you were hunting an extremely skittish wild animal was the advice he gave us.
Yeah.
We decided in the interests of time and the interests of getting data as quickly as possible to move quicker than Tom Gorman was advising. But, you know, as it turned out, there was still plenty of activity on the property.
Yeah.
When we moved on, it was not like everything shut down, but there was a difference in flavor to the events that happened once we moved on and, you know, the Gormans had moved out.
Now, did you ever live like on the ranch? I know you guys, sometimes they would spend time there. Did you actually spend time there and live there? Or cause earlier in the book, you referenced being flown from Vegas to the ranch when that first calf gets
slaughtered. Yeah, well, beginning in 1996, in September of 1996, we would be on the ranch. We would live on the ranch for 5-7 days. And then we would come back to Vegas for a couple of days. Then we would go back to the ranch for 5-7 days. So we were living most of the time on the ranch for the first year and a half, with the exception being once the temperature plunged down below zero up in northeastern Utah.
Oh yeah.
We came back to Vegas. We were in constant daily conversations with Tom Gorman. And he would report anything unusual. We would make the decision to fly up there or not. We did have a private jet at our disposal, which is an unusual facility for a research team. And, you know, as you mentioned, in March of 1997, we were actually on the point of going up there anyway when we got the call that an 84-pound calf had been dismembered in broad daylight on the property. So we got on the private jet. We moved up to Utah. We were standing over the animal within literally 4 to 5 hours of the phone call, and that the animal was lying on the grass with its all four legs spread eagled on the grass. All of the internal organs were gone. The ribs had been cut open, and everything was the entire body cavity was empty. There was not a drop of blood on the animal or underneath the animal, and this had all happened a few hours previously when Tom Gorman and his wife were tagging these newly born calves. They had just tagged this particular animal, moved down the property about 300 yards to tag another animal when they noticed the dog that was with them began behaving kind of strangely.
Yeah.
So they went back to investigate the source of the dog's discomfort, and they found this calf they had just tagged 45 minutes earlier. And remember, this is like 11 o'clock in the morning. This was a bright, sunny day. Everything looked peaceful, except for the fact that this calf that they had tagged previously had been completely dismembered in broad daylight with no sound. These two people were only 300 yards away. Both had excellent hearing. Both had excellent eyesight. They didn't see or hear a thing. So we had a veterinarian as part of the research team who instantly started conducting a necropsy on the dead calf. First thing he noticed was that the ear, which had carried this new ear tag, had been sliced off to the skull, and his initial impressions was a sharp instrument had been used. But he took samples anyway. He sent those samples to three different independent veterinary pathology labs who confirmed his initial observation that sharp instruments had been used on this ear. There was also one of the femur bones had been forcibly ripped out of the animal and was lying on the grass about 10 feet away from the animal when we discovered it. We packaged this bone off, sent it to one of the top forensic laboratories in the country, who came back then later saying that two separate different sharp instruments had been used on this bone, one a heavy machete instrument and the other like a light, like tweezers, scissors kind of instrument. So there was strong evidence that this animal certainly had been killed in association with sharp instruments. The cause of death was not immediately known, except the animal had been totally dismembered. And the fact that there was not a single drop of blood on the animal or underneath the animal was really spooky to look at, because this animal should have had between 2 and 3 liters of blood.
Oh, yeah.
If you slash an animal's throat, you know, there's blood everywhere, you know, when you're killing them. And to have this done completely silently in the presence of a couple of very alert people 300 yards away is even more spooky. So, we got the services of a professional tracker on the spot to start looking for tracks. He spent the next several days quartering the property within a quarter to half a mile radius of this dead animal, and found pretty well no tracks, no evidence whatsoever. And this guy makes a living from tracking, so it's not like this was the first time he was doing this, and there was no tracks whatsoever. So whatever happened in terms of this 84-pound calf was a pretty unique method of killing. It showed signs of tremendous force. In other words, it does take a lot of force to rip the femur away from the ball and socket joint, tear all the ligaments from the femur of even a newborn calf, and lay it on the grass. And the way the animal had been laid on the grass also was very unusual, is that it was obviously placed there, carefully placed there. It was not thrown there in a heap of bones and flesh. It was carefully placed there with all four legs spreading to, you know, different points of the compass. It was obviously very carefully done, whatever that operation or whoever did that operation. So the forensic analysis definitely tied it to sharp instruments. So this was not a predator attack. It was a very skillful operation carried out by people who were fairly well acquainted with surgery.
Now, one thing that stood out for me when I was reading the book was sort of on the theme of digging, because when the Gormans first bought the ranch and the property in the sale, it was that they couldn't dig without prior permission or something like that.
Yeah.
And then later you say you guys consulted some remote viewers, and they said there was something under the ground. And then later you said you guys dug into the ground at some point, and it seemed to cause some UFOs to come around. How extensive did you guys investigate that aspect of the ranch?
Well, we actually imported a big caterpillar digger up onto the property.
Yeah.
And we used that to periodically dig these large trenches on the property, because the Gorman family had told us a series of anecdotes when they started changing the overall topography, that they found that it seemed to be a signal for an increase in intensity of this activity. So we decided to see if we could stimulate the activity,
because it was
very, very difficult to capture anything on the fly, so to speak, because we never knew when or where anything would erupt or what kind of incidents would happen. So
yeah.
we decided to try to be more proactive. So we started digging on the property, large 50-yard long trenches, this kind of thing, alter the topography. And in several cases, within, say, 72, 96 hours, neighbors would begin reporting increases in activity. We never actually captured the activity, the so-called quote-unquote response to digging on the property, but we did find that it did seem to elicit some kind of a reaction, albeit a delayed reaction. But we were never able to capture the evidence of that reaction on the, you know, in a way that the Science Advisory Board found acceptable.
Yeah. Now, during all this time, you guys were at the ranch because of the original publicity for the Gormans. It became quite a hotbed of rumors in the esoteric world. What did you think about that at the time? And were you hearing from people in, you know, ufology and cryptozoology and various fields trying to get information on what was going on there?
Yeah, we were getting, I'd say, weekly to monthly communications from all of the above, people who wanted to get on the property, people who had heard about what the Gorman family had been through. They had heard about NIDS purchasing the property because that made the media also. There was a couple of newspaper stories about it. So it became notorious very quickly, and we decided to try to professionalize this investigation by basically clamping down on publicity and try to set this area up as a laboratory of the paranormal, install equipment, install personnel, and do scientific research without being disturbed by you know, people who are trying to encroach on the property, people who are trying to get on the property for whatever reason. So the idea was that if and when anything materialized in terms of scientific validity from this investigation on the property, then we'd be in a position to publish it, we'd be in a position to talk about it. But before that, we had no intention of publicizing what we were doing.
Yeah.
And that's, in our view, still a legitimate way to conduct science. Science by press conference is always a bad idea. And this, of course, led to a whole slew of rumors in the esoteric fields that, you know, we were covering up evidence, that we were in contact with aliens, that we were, you know, trying to, you know, invite the CIA onto the property, this kind of thing. So there was multiple different conspiracy scenarios spun out of the fact that we were not willing to go on the record about the kind of research we were doing. And the reason we weren't willing to go on the record was because we were trying to conduct a legitimate scientific investigation, and the idea is to gather the data before you actually start talking about it.
Yeah. Yes. Did you have a lot of incidents where people trying to break into the ranch, or was it pretty, like, after a while, like, people knew not to bother with, like, Area 51 type situations?
Well, we had constant surveillance of the property perimeters, and actually that surveillance continues to this day. So it was always monitored. There were people always there. And there still are. So, I mean, it was difficult for people to encroach on the property, even though some people did try.
Yeah.
It became pretty obvious during the tenure of NIDS on the property that there were, you know, police would be called, and any trespassers would be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. So there was an active discouragement of people getting on the property, and it was pretty successful. After the first spate of media publicity died down, there were very few incursions.
That's good. Now I know NIDS sort of has stepped down on the ranch investigation, but you guys did the Black Triangle UFO study, and you did sort of like a sister investigation in Dulce. What other sort of studies have you guys done that you can talk about or anything like that?
We've looked in several different areas around the country, primarily, as you mentioned, Dulce, New Mexico, and also northeastern Utah. But we've done a fair number of studies down around in the Buckeye area in Arizona, where there's been a lot of reported sightings, where the famous Phoenix Triangle was associated with that area, and we've gone to targeted areas in California on occasion to investigate alleged incursions, and also We've actually gone out east on the odd occasion too, but primarily our focus has been in the southwest of the country.
Yeah. So what made you?
We have investigated. You know, we actually sent people out to Illinois during the famous January 2000 Black Triangle incident. Flew over Scott Air Force Base. So NIDS was pretty active around the country in investigating targeted sightings that were considered, considered worthy of investigation. But in general, the vast majority of the time, especially during the years 1996 through 2000, were spent either in northern New Mexico or in northeastern Utah.
Now, what made you guys decide to do sort of like a separate study on the Black Triangle UFOs?
Well, it basically fell across the desk, and once we had published the results of the Illinois sighting, it became sort of commonplace for people to start reporting sightings of these mysterious black triangles on to our website, and we got hundreds and hundreds of reports. So it was not by design that we jumped into the black triangle thing. And people started contacting us. People started reporting these incidents.
Yeah.
We actually opened a hotline, and we got literally hundreds of different incidents from around the country, and we interviewed all of the people involved. In some cases, 17 to 20 eyewitnesses, for example. There was another famous one in Carteret, New Jersey in 2001 that we investigated. We interviewed about 20 separate eyewitnesses, and we triangulated the sighting. But in general, I think the so-called Skinwalker Ranch was and continued to be a pretty unique area where a laboratory of these unusual incidents could be set up and studied very, very closely, because that's one of the holy grails really in this kind of research is to really focus as deeply as possible and gather as many data as possible on as many incidents as possible. And that's what we did in Utah, and the results that came out of it, as we published in this book, was a bewildering variety of different incidents that spanned all across the field of cryptozoology, paranormal, ghost hunting, ufology. All of these phenomena have been divided neatly into different categories. And what was really astounding about the Utah experience was that these boundaries seem to be totally irrelevant to what was unfolding on the property in Utah. It was one moment it was cryptozoology, the next moment it was these weird flying objects, including these large black triangles. The next moment it would be silver discs or Mexican hat-shaped UFOs, and next minute would be cattle mutilation. So it seemed to be a Grand Central Station where multiple incidents erupted. And as we mentioned in the book, there's been a traditional sort of separation between these disciplines. Cryptozoologists don't usually study UFOs, and nuts and bolts ufologists don't usually study Bigfoot, and ghost hunters tend to keep their distance, and people who are into discarnate voices and hauntings and poltergeist activity tend to view the whole UFO subject with disdain. And so there's these multiple camps in these esoteric areas that are completely separate. But the Utah Ranch, the so-called Skinwalker Ranch, had the effect of uniting all of these. And we were in a position of having either to throw out the data or else include all of the data. And we were determined to keep an open mind on this whole project and to recount, to document all of these incidents as closely as possible and not throw anything out because they didn't fit into a particular pigeonhole. Just because in exactly the same area of the property, a flying object had been witnessed a week before, where this week there was a dead cow that had obviously been sliced up, then Was there a connection between these two incidents? We have no way of knowing, but there was certainly a geographical connection in that they had happened right on the same spot in the same area of the property. We still have no idea of whether or not there was a temporal or a cause and effect connection between these kinds of disparate incidents, or was it some kind of an attractor, sort of a geographical attractor, for whatever reason this particular property was attracting all this weird stuff. I should also mention that this ranch is located in an area of northeastern Utah that has had at least a 50-year history, possibly even longer, of a whole variety of bizarre flying object incidents, UFO incidents going back to about 1950, 1951. The reason we know that is that way back at that time, the local science teacher in the local high school began to collect the reports that were coming in from the local population, and he was he had sufficient credibility in the local community that he was able to collect these incidents and keep confidentiality. So he accumulated over the years hundreds and hundreds of high quality reports, and the ranch is located exactly in the center of that whole area that had been subject to all this weird activity since the early 1950s. Now, whether or not the incidents that were happening on the ranch were a good snapshot of the incidents that were happening elsewhere, we don't know, because we know that this retired school teacher had collected so many different incidents over time that he began to skew the collection method towards only the most spectacular sightings of flying objects. Because his feeling was, he could spend all day, every day, interviewing people regarding all of the different weird things that had happened to them in this area of Utah. He decided to skew his investigation only towards the most spectacular multiple incident sightings of UFOs. So a lot of the stuff that had happened on the property had also happened in different areas of Utah, but it just simply were not reported.
Now, like, you just spoke to the sociological aspects of the different sects of research in esoterica, and that sort of speaks to the only real skeptical argument I've heard from anyone is that they sort of just shut down when they hear about all the incidents, and they say, that's too much for one thing.
Right.
Have you heard that sort of argument from people before?
Definitely, yes, and it's curious because it really, I think, is severely dependent on the amount of time that you spend in a given location, and it is dependent on the amount of trust that local people have. Over the years, we did gain a lot of trust from the local inhabitants, and we were able to get from them a lot of the kinds of incidents that had happened to them. And there was a lot of overlap with what had happened on the ranch. So when people say it's too much, you know, it may be just a matter of the fact that they have not spent enough time investigating a particular property, you know, for weeks or even months at a time. So we actually saw exactly the same thing in northern New Mexico. We arrived, we began investigating. The first thing we heard was a bunch of strange UFO incidents, but the deeper we began to dig, the more and more incidents that began to emerge, and you know, people were sort of less willing to come up front with a lot of strange incidents than they were sort of to recount sort of the usual UFOs flying over. But the deeper you dug, the weirder the incidents became as the trust was built up. So we think that there was probably a factor in that. In many of these so-called hotspots around the country, if you spend a lot of time digging, you find a lot more than you originally encounter.
Yeah. Now, Robert Bigelow, he obviously bought the ranch. Was the NIDS project sort of like a side thing for him? The main question is, did he ever go to the ranch? Did he ever go and check it out himself? Or was it sort of like this is a side, like an R&D type thing for his enterprise?
Oh, he spent weeks literally on the ranch conducting night watches with
oh, wow.
Staff. You know, I mean, he was right hands on the property. He was he was up there with night vision binoculars till 4 or 5 a.m. watching just like everybody else. He was totally captivated by all of these, you know, the scientific way of looking at this, because that's why he funded this whole thing, was to see if he could get some answers to these unusual phenomena. So he was not kind of a remote figure that was sort of off doing other stuff. He was very much involved with the property, very much involved with the research, and on a daily basis, he was either calling people or we were calling him based on incidents if he couldn't actually be there. So he was a very hands-on research guy.
Yeah. All right, why don't you say to the people who are like, well, obviously, in the esoteric field, there's always a want for money, pretty much. Everybody needs money to do their research. And what do you say to the critics who are like, why won't he spend money on my developing research? And do you ever get people who say that kind of thing?
Well, we got numerous, you know, applications for funding from everybody from the SETI people, the so-called Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence people. We got almost weekly requests for various funding of various projects. And what we did in response to some of these requests was we actually did investigate some of these, but on NID's terms. In other words, Robert Bigelow did fund some of these research projects, but NIDS had to be involved in the research because we weren't just going to throw money at at these kinds of idle sort of requests for money without making absolutely sure that there was a good business case to be made in terms of return on investment. That may sound sort of harshly business-like, but NIDS was run completely professionally as a business organization. You know, individual time was accounted for, individual effort was accounted for. So there was none of this kind of let's throw $10,000 at this person who wants to set up some kind of a monitoring station somewhere. If we were going to be involved, certainly financially, we were going to be involved physically too.
Yeah. Now, like as you allude to in the book, the activity at the ranch sort of tapered down. Is that what factored in you guys' decision to release the book now? Because, like you said before, you weren't really interested in publicity, and now obviously with this book, you're going to have to pay extra for security up there.
Well, the main driver for actually publicizing this was George Knapp, who co-wrote the book.
Yeah.
Because in 2002, he's had a long, long-standing relationship with Robert Bigelow that even precedes the formation of NIDS. And what he wanted to do was to go on the record, if possible, with some of the incidents on the property. And in 2002, and we agreed to it because we thought it would be a good way of finding out from the feedback to this publicity the numbers of other hotspots around the country.
Oh, yeah.
Indeed, around the world. So we did it with our eyes open, knowing that there would be an increase in publicity, which is exactly what happened. So we got a lot of feedback. George Knapp wrote two articles in the local Las Vegas newspaper that, you know, they were called Path of the Skinwalker, and they really went around the world, literally went around the world. Our website was getting, you know, thousands of hits from all around the world. So subsequent to that, George was the main driver in saying, and Robert Bigelow did agree to this, that some of the events could be described in book form. And this is really a sort of a personal narrative of my time and George's investigative time on this property over the span of the research project. Now, NIDS does still exist. It is on ice, but if there is any major resurgence in the kinds of activity that we were exposed to in 1996 and 1997, 98, then you know, new people would be hired and the whole thing would be revived. But the property still exists. It is still ongoing activity at a much lower level, but you know, and it is still under surveillance. So the same thing applies to people who are thinking of encroaching on the property as it did back in 1996, 1997. They are not welcome.
You heard that, people. Don't show up there. You said the point of the book was to get feedback. So far, obviously, the book's only been off for like 2 months, maybe 3 months now. What would you say about the feedback you've gotten so far? How's it shaped up?
Well, the feedback has been enormous, actually. It's been on all sorts of email lists. It's been sold out on Amazon.com a couple of times. It's been
nice.
It's actually in a second printing now.
Oh, wow.
Already, and it only came out on December 6th, which is So a lot of copies people are really interested in finding out what exactly happened on this property. So yeah, it's doing really well, and we've got a lot of interesting feedback from different folks. Now, you know, there's a lot of people who are talking about similar incidents that have happened, and it's becoming really obvious that the ranch may not be as unique as people have talked about.
Yeah. Now, at the end of the book, you go through a variety of scenarios that may have been the source of the activity at the ranch. Where are you sort of leaning yourself personally? What do you think? Interdimensional type of situation?
Well, one of the things that Tom Gorman used to talk about all of the time was this peculiar thing that he used to see up about a mile from his from where he lived. And this was still on the property. This large orange object would appear out of nowhere, and he took to spending a lot of time out on his property looking at this orange object.
Yeah.
And occasionally, with a scope, he would look into this orange object, and he told me on a couple of occasions he saw like a different sky, different shape, a different color sky through the scope through this orange object.
Wow.
And he figured it was some kind of a different world out there. We never actually saw that. We only saw the different phenomena. As I mentioned, you know, the Gorman looking through the scope, this rifle scope at the at what was in the orange hole. On one occasion, he actually saw through the scope this black object that was obviously moving quickly from this other side, so to speak.
Yeah.
Moving in his direction. He could see it against the clear blue sky, and as it moved in his direction, it was getting bigger and bigger, and it was moving extremely quickly. He lost it once it transited into the darkness from where he was, but it came from what looked like a bright sky, you know, as he looked through it.
Yeah.
So he figured, you know, maybe that was some kind of evidence for something, you know, to do with different dimensions or different realities. Whether or not that explains all of the events, we don't have enough evidence to really pinpoint.
Yeah.
But, you know, the dimensional explanation is certainly an attractive one, in that, you know, all of the where did all of these weird animals come from that were tracked on that property?
Yeah.
You know, Gorman used to talk about these incredibly brightly colored tiny birds that were more like tropical birds that appeared and disappeared. There were these large wolves that were on the property that were seen not only by the Gormans but by neighbors, and there was a variety of different animals that NID's staff encountered that were actually shot at on a number of occasions, and there were no blood, no tracks kind of thing. So where did those animals come from? We really have no way of knowing, because there was so little physical evidence left on the ground following something like that. The exception being, of course, the dismembered calf that I talked about, and occasionally there were other animals mutilated on the property too.
Now, when in your time out there, what was the single like freakiest moment for you where you were like, this is paranormal, man, this is crazy? What was the scariest thing for you as a modest?
I think in June 1997, when myself and this physicist were standing out on the property, we were right out in the middle of this small pasture where previously, the previous week, a really spectacular series of infrared images had been photographed in this small pasture. And so we were staking the place out to see if we could recapture some of those, if anything was going to happen.
Yeah.
We would capture on infrared film. So this was about midnight. It was June. It was completely quiet. This place is so isolated. You know, it's the only thing you can see is the night sky, really. Everything else is just black around the place. So about 70 to 100 feet to our left, suddenly out of nowhere, the whole place lit up. This basketball-sized object that was bluish-white was hovering about 15 feet off the ground. It was emitting this intense blue-white light, showed up on the ground, and it was just hovering there. It seemed like it was bouncing slightly, and then 5 seconds later, it just suddenly disappeared. So we had these law enforcement type flashlights that are, you know, that we can light up the whole pasture instantly.
Yeah.
So we slammed them on and ran over to the spot. There was absolutely nothing there. There was no evidence anything had happened. So we were kind of definitely in alert mode at that stage. So we went back to the original spot, shut off the spotlight, the flashlights, and resumed operation. So the physicist with me had a set of ITT night vision binoculars, which are ambient light enhancement binoculars, and he was scanning the perimeter of the field. I was focusing on I had a camera with infrared film. The idea was to try to get infrared shots like the investigator had done previously in that same spot. So physicists started reporting that right in front of him was there was a bank of trees about 100 feet right in front of us. He started reporting this big black amorphous, it almost looked like a cloud, was in the tree line moving within the trees, blocking out all the stars behind as he was looking through his infrared binoculars. Now, standing right beside him, I started taking these infrared photographs, see if we could record anything.
Yeah.
But the physicist became very agitated. He said that something had interfered with him, had locked onto his brain, how he described it later. But that some voice was telling him that he was being watched, or we were being watched. So remember, this was out in the black of night.
Oh,
we were sort of standing totally defenseless with whatever was in the darkness 100 feet ahead, informing this NASA physicist who was, the guy was not prone to fantasy, that he was being watched. Naturally, you know, he started getting very agitated. So he then reported this thing moving through the trees slowly. It began to collapse in on itself is the way he described it, and gradually just kind of vanished. So during that whole period, I was taking these long exposure infrared photographs, and eventually, you know, when we developed the film, there was very, very little you could see on the phone, certainly nothing you could really analyze with any confidence. So that was one of the incidents, because it really sort of drove it home how completely defenseless we were out there in the middle of nowhere. We did obviously have a system of backup if there was any real trouble, but it was definitely a spooky incident.
Now, do you find, like, you lived through that situation and everything, but do you find it frustrating then when you tried to, like, to produce some kind of evidence, but it was never really forthcoming? Like, but you experience it. You know what's going on there. So is it frustrating?
Well, we found it obviously very frustrating because, the basic premise of a scientific investigation is to gather evidence and gather evidence that's reproducible. So when you're in a situation where none of the variables are controlled, when you have no way of being at the right place at the right time, you've no way of controlling any part of the experiment, you're basically at the mercy of something that is out there. You've no idea what it is. So that part of the whole investigative process became very frustrating, because as the book title says, Hunt for the Skinwalker, we were hunting something. We didn't know what it was. We knew that it had terrorized this family for 20 months. We knew that all of these incidents were happening on our watch. You know, we were constantly chasing something that was ephemeral. It was transient. It was, you know, that we could not get our teeth into it. It always seemed to be one step ahead of us. And it displayed some parts of this whole trickster mentality or trickster, category that a lot of the Native Americans talk about. And in that it is totally unexpected. It is never, never predictable. And it's almost, we got the feeling at times that it was almost toying with us.
Yeah.
And that may have been our sort of our way of interpreting what was happening, but there did seem to be this whole trickster phenomenon that was going on. So yeah, from a scientific perspective, it was a very, very frustrating cat and mouse game because, you know, we had the psychology of we're going after this thing, we're going to capture whatever we can on film, we're going to write it up, we're going to document it, and hopefully we're going to publish a paper on it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that was our perspective, and this, whatever this was on the property was not cooperating in any way.
Now, I'm always interested in what the perspective of the people who are featured in a book, like after it comes out, did Tom Gorman or his wife or his kids or anything, did they read the book? Have you heard from them post-publication of Hunt for the Skinwalker?
Not so far, but we did make a promise to the family to protect the family as much as humanly possible from any publicity. So we changed their names.
Yeah.
We altered certain parts of their background and that kind of thing to make sure that people would not start to try to track them. Even though, you know, there was a publicity about them in 1996, and people who were diligent enough will probably be able to track back at their original names, etc. But our promise to the family was, look, we are not in any way interested in disturbing your peace of mind. So the idea is not to contact the family and to let them live their lives. They want to put this whole thing behind them. They were terrorized and they were traumatized by something they don't understand. But, you know, they've been living a life in another state for many, many years. They've had no recurrence of these incidents, and they want to just get on with their lives because not only were they terrorized on their property, but the local community where they were living in northeastern Utah didn't take particularly kindly to this sudden upsurge in bizarre wild stories that was centered in their small community. They're a very private community in northeastern Utah, very religious, and you know, they're not really too keen on a lot of media attention.
Yeah. Final question, really, what's next for you and then NIDS in general?
Well, I think NIDS is going to be reactivated when and if it's deemed that there's enough activity to really really get the research, serious research, into. From my perspective, I'm now currently employed in the biotechnology industry. My background is in molecular biology and in biochemistry. So I'm back doing what I was doing before this project came up way back in 1996. So,
oh, wow.
I'm obviously extremely interested in looking at all of these esoteric subjects, but I'm not particularly interested in spending the rest of my life full-time exploring these topics because our experience at the Skinwalker Ranch was that the more you chase something like this, the more opaque it becomes. So these kinds of topics, from my perspective, you can spend a whole lifetime and really get nowhere.
Yeah. Yeah, see, it's just better to not watch the pot, and then it'll boil, sort of thing.
Exactly. Exactly.
And the book is available, like you said, via Amazon.com. Is it in the bookstores too, Barnes & Noble, Borders?
Yep, it's in Borders, Barnes & Noble. It's in bookstores nationwide.
Awesome.
In many cases, as I mentioned, it's been sold out. So if it's not there when you go there, you can certainly order it.
Yeah,
Amazon.com. There's also our website, huntfortheskinwalker.com, which is, it's got some added information there, and also some of the photographs, that kind of thing from the property. So it's an interesting read.
Yeah, I highly recommend it. It was a really good book. I enjoyed it a lot. I whipped right through it like in 3 or 4 days, and it's just chilling at times. It's frightening. It's exciting. It's like you said, it's a hunt, and you're sort of in on the hunt. And I really enjoyed it a lot. I highly recommend it. I have a feeling many of the listeners have already read the book because everybody was talking about it since December when it came out. And hopefully those who are sitting on their duff will have gone out and picked it up and check it out. And do you have an additional website that you want me to mention?
I do have the website on the Mad Cow Brain Trust book, which is www.colmkelleher.com, C-O-L-M-K-E-L-L-E-H-E-R.
And are you going to do any more Mad Cow stuff in the future, you think?
Yeah, I'm very interested in this whole subject, and I think as time goes on and this whole link between chronic wasting disease and humans eating potentially contaminated venison is an additional layer of complexity onto the mad cow situation that already is here in North America. So I'll be keeping a close eye on that too.
Awesome. Maybe in the future I can have you back and we'll talk about that. Thank you very much, Colm Kelleher, for appearing on Banal America Audio. It was a great interview, and I appreciated you giving me the time to talk about the book. The book is Hunt for the Skinwalker. As he said, it's available nationwide. Pick it up. Read it. You're going to love it. Colm Kelleher, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Glad to be here.
That does it for this week's edition of Banal of America Audio. I want to thank Colm Kelleher for stopping by and being on the show. You can find out more information on Colm Kelleher at www.colmkelleher.com. That's C-O-L-M-K-E-L-L-E-H-E-R.com. And you can find more information about the book at www.huntfortheskinwalker.com. And that's Huntfortheskinwalker.com. Big thanks to Leslie and Chiron of BanalofAmerica.com for your help and support with the audio series, and big thanks to R. Lee of BanalofAmerica.com, one of our newest columnists. She's been on board for about 6 weeks or so here at BanalofAmerica.com, and she's been a great help with the audio series as well, so thank you, R. Lee. And, of course, I want to thank all the great listeners out there who have found us worldwide. I'm getting emails from all over the world. It's really amazing, and I'm seeing links to Banal of America Audio posted all over the internet, and it's just amazing, and I really appreciate it. You can find daily updates, sometimes twice a day, on rare occasions 3 times a day, updates at banalofamerica.com. Columnists Leslie, Chiron, R. Lee, they put out weekly columns. They are amazing stuff. You've got to check those out. I, of course, write the Banal Report and a couple other columns and feature articles at banalofamerica.com. If you are just discovering us, definitely check out the website. If you have been a frequent listener and you haven't had a chance to check out banalofamerica.com, please do so. You will love it, I'm sure. And that you can find at www.binnalofamerica.com. I would be remiss in not mentioning that we have a PayPal button up for donations for folks who want to throw some change in the bucket and help Banal of America Audio keep rolling on down the line. You can click the PayPal button, you can make a donation, and it would help offset some of the expenses that we incur as we produce this remarkable audio series that you have come to know as Banal of America Audio. Next week, we've got Steve Bassett. He's the founder of the Paradigm Research Group, founder of the X Conference. He's a lobbyist on the UFO issue. He ran for Congress in 2002 on the UFO ticket. He is a key figure in the disclosure movement now. He will be on Banal of America Audio to talk about the Paradigm Research Group, being a lobbyist on the UFO issue, his 2002 Congress run on the UFO ticket. We're going to talk all about that. We're going to talk about the X Conference, what it's like to set it up, the business aspects of it. We're going to talk about the big stories in exopolitics for 2005, the Hellyer story, the Brazilian disclosure story, some of the India Daily stories, that strange trend coming out of India, and tons more, and that's just the first installment. This is a massive interview, spanned over 3 hours. It'll be broken up into 2 weeks, as we do for our big ones. Next week, we'll be talking about all that stuff I just talked about. In 2 weeks, even more stuff. I'll preview that next week. It's going to be Steve Bassett next week on Banal of America Audio, February 11th, 2006. Until you hear from me then, thanks for listening, folks. This is Tim Banal, signing off.